This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we'll talk to the artist behind hundreds of ski trail maps around the world.
Whenever I paint a trail map, I paint it for the skier, not for the resort.
We'll also look at the business of the ski industry.
And what it means to be getting good at responding to mass shootings.
So the people who had witnessed the shooting and were upset, they were able to get help immediately.
That's coming up.
It's Wednesday, November 6th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Colorado voters have soundly rejected Proposition CC, which would have let the state legislature keep money that would otherwise be refunded to taxpayers. And we got those results last night, but the other statewide ballot measure kept us on our toes right up until we taped this.
Proposition DD, which would set up a new regulated sports betting market in Colorado, has narrowly passed. According to the Secretary of State's website, 50.73% of voters are in favor of the measure. Certification of the final results will take several weeks, however. Here to update us with the latest is KUNC's Luke Runyon. Hey, Luke.
Hi, Henry.
Why was this vote so close?
It was close for a few reasons. This was an off-year election cycle, so already you're going to see some limited turnout. And then you have just Colorado's general distaste for passing tax increases of any kind. I talked with DD's legislative sponsor, Democratic House Majority Leader Alec Garnett, and this is what he had to say.
Going in, we always knew that proposing a new tax is tough, and the way that the language was written, it wasn't crystal clear to the voter, I don't think, exactly what was before them. It was some pretty complicated language.
And I think the reason the close vote was surprising is because a lot of the buzz about DD was that it was a pretty sure bet. The proponents were well-funded, they were organized, and they felt like they had a winning message of this being a tax on casinos, not the average voter, and the opposition was pretty minimal. It's just another reminder to state lawmakers that even these narrower tax measures aren't a surefire way of raising revenue.
What's next for sports betting?
If the lead holds and DD passes, Colorado would join the 17 or so other states that have some form of sports gambling right now. It would start up in May of next year, and only existing casinos in the state would be eligible to earn those sports gambling licenses. So this is a pretty significant expansion of gaming in the state, but the actual footprint of gaming establishments isn't going to get that much bigger, if that makes sense. But it is likely that the existing casinos in Central City, Blackhawk, Cripple Creek, they would contract out with mobile sports betting platforms so that you wouldn't be limited to just betting in person at those casinos, which is kind of a big change for the state.
A key point of this proposition is that sports betting will be taxed, and that money will go toward the Colorado Water Plan. Right now, it's said that Prop DD will generate maybe somewhere between $6 and $15 million for that plan annually. How much does that plan really need?
And just some background on the Colorado Water Plan itself. This is a document that came from a huge grassroots planning process in the state and was finalized in 2015 under former Governor John Hickenlooper. It lays out the state's priorities for closing this gap between future water supplies and demands. And it called for some pretty ambitious targets for new supplies and for conservation. And up until now, it hasn't had a dedicated funding source. The plan calls for about $100 million in annual spending on water projects. So this amount from sports betting will bring in just a fraction of that.
Luke Runyon is a reporter for KUNC. Luke, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The Secretary of State reports that more than 1.5 million ballots were submitted this year, around 40% of all registered voters. For even more election results, visit our website, KUNC.org.
We just told you about the tight race on the statewide proposition about sports betting. Now we turn to another close vote from yesterday, this one from Fort Collins City Council. The council narrowly approved new zoning for the land where the old Hughes Stadium once stood, which is now an open space on the city's southwest side, paving the way for a big new development there. KUNC's Matt Bloom was at that meeting and joins us now to walk us through what happened. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Erin.
So the decision was about new zoning for the land. What exactly does that mean?
It means development is much more likely to happen now. How many homes, what it's going to look like is still all up in the air. City planning staff guess that the way they zoned it could make way for about 550 homes, which is a lot of homes.
That's a significant number.
And city council member Emily Gorgel, who supported this rezoning, talked about how this way forward is really the best compromise.
We as a city council said that our priority is housing, affordable and attainable, and transit options. Those are the two biggest things I've heard from my community.
It also means that an effort from some Fort Collins residents to keep the land undeveloped, untouched, is less likely to happen now.
And clearly more housing, and especially more affordable housing, is a priority in the city. But on the other hand, having green space is also really important to people. You talked to a lot of residents who were there last night who want that space to stay open.
Mary Alice Grant was there handing out little green papers for people to wave during the meeting in support of keeping the space open. And she said she felt disappointed and powerless.
I don't think that they have adequately looked at what the community wants. So the community loses again.
I sat through a couple hours of public comment and watched person after person. And what stood out to me is that this project has kind of become a lightning rod for some broader anxieties that we're seeing around growth.
Colorado State University still owns the land, which puts them in sort of a tricky position where they have to balance competing priorities for what is done with the land. What did they have to say?
The school spokesman, Mike Hooker, read a statement from Tony Frank. He's the chancellor of the CSU system. And he supports plans to develop the area in a way that balances a lot of those competing interests.
We remain committed to evaluating reinvestment of a portion of the proceeds into attainable and potentially affordable housing for CSU employees.
An interesting point that came up from the council, too, was that they're essentially powerless when it comes to requiring affordable housing during the zoning process. That means it's kind of up to CSU and the developer.
And the developer, Lennar, was there, too, at the meeting. What did they have to say about those commitments?
They had a representative there who spoke very briefly. He said that we look forward to working with the city to make this a great community. They're trying to make some of the development attainable housing, quote unquote, for the community. But it's still unclear what that looks like.
What's next for development?
There's still a long, long way to go with this. The $10 million sale between CSU and Lennar hasn't actually gone through yet, but it's more likely to now that this zoning process has wrapped up.
Matt Bloom, a reporter for KUNC, thank you so much for following this.
No problem.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
And let's start with some news from the upcoming 2020 election. Democratic Senator Michael Bennet signed up for New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation presidential primary today, ahead of the November 15th deadline. The Colorado senator says he's counting on voters there to once again upset conventional wisdom. That is likely a reference to Gary Hart, the former Colorado senator who pulled off an upset win in 1984. The next Democratic presidential debate is on November 20th. Bennet has not yet qualified for it.
Enrollment in Medicaid and Child Health Plus in Colorado declined between 2017 and 2019. According to an analysis from the Colorado Center on Law and Policy, both programs saw an 8% decline in enrollment. The nonprofit suggests several reasons for the decline: federal changes to Medicaid qualifications, difficulty staying enrolled, and fluctuating income levels throughout the year.
Farmers producing some of Colorado's most iconic specialty crops will be getting $745,000 in federal funding. That includes Rocky Ford melons and Palisade peaches. The money will help growers expand their markets and improve growing and distribution techniques. This was also the first year that local cider producers received some of the funding. Hard cider is a rapidly emerging market in Colorado.
After a mass shooting, people and resources pour in to help victims and survivors cope. And as these incidents continue to happen, this grim infrastructure of people is growing larger and more sophisticated. KUNC's Lee Patterson brings us more.
I caught up with Sandy Phillips on her cell phone in a rental car.
We are traveling 95 from D.C. to Virginia Beach.
Sandy and her husband Lonnie usually have bags ready to go, but they were already on the road. this trip was a detour.
We need to stop and buy underwear and some clothing to get through the rest of the week. But this is just part of what we do.
What the Phillips do is travel around the country to the sites of mass shootings.
The first one that we went to was 5 months after my daughter was killed.
Sandy's daughter, Jessica, died in the Aurora Theater shooting in 2012. When I talked with them in June, they were headed down to Virginia Beach. A dozen people had just been killed in a shooting at a municipal building. This incident was number 11 for them. When they arrived, they first went to the site of the shooting to pay their respects and talk to police. Then they headed over to the rec center to try and meet with survivors, though people don't always want to talk.
The first thing we always tell them about is that, you know, we understand exactly what they're feeling because we've been in their shoes, and that right now you don't even feel like you want to live. You just want to curl up and die. And that's a normal part of the trauma that you have endured.
A few months later, I met up with Sandy and Lonnie on the outdoor patio of a restaurant in Aurora, not far from Denver. And I asked them, since they started doing this work, what's changed?
Unfortunately, I think we've become more sophisticated, which is good, but so very sad at the same time that we have allowed this to redefine our country in such a way that we're getting good at how we respond to mass shootings.
The Phillips themselves have become more sophisticated over the years. Now they give advice on how to deal with reporters, what to do about online harassment, and how to spot scammers trying to make money off of tragedy. Eric Pearson, president of the El Paso Community Foundation, is dealing with these kinds of financial issues after a gunman killed 22 people at a Walmart there in August.
Each person has an individual set of needs that, and an individual situation that we're trying to deal with. A good example is, you know, how bad is the injury? What does that mean to you in terms of caring for your children?
He's talked with national and community foundations that have managed funds after other mass shootings. He says it's disturbing that there's almost a playbook for doing this work, but
we're not walking through the forest blind. There's a path in front of us that if we can find our part of that path, we can do right by this community.
During our interview, Sandy Phillips described a predictable group of people who always seem to show up to mass shootings. The guy from Illinois who makes the white crosses. Religious groups like the Billy Graham Rapid Response Team, the lady from the Red Cross, and more recently, therapy dogs. They came to El Paso with Janice Marut from Lutheran Church Charities.
They're comfort dogs. These dogs live in Nebraska, Colorado, and Texas.
The Golden Retrievers were stationed at the city's memorial near the baseball stadium not long after the shooting.
Oh, we've been to Orlando, Santa Fe, Harvey, Sutherland Springs. I mean, tornadoes, floods, fires, just wherever we're asked to go. Unfortunately, too many shootings.
Lonnie and Sandy Phillips were in El Paso, too. And this time, they ran into a new organized group of people that they had never really seen before. Dozens of trauma therapists meeting with victims at the community center and hospitals.
So the people who had witnessed the shooting and were upset, they were able to get help immediately. And that's what we've been preaching for 7 years.
And it's the new project they're working on right now, building teams of survivors and trauma therapists to go into communities after incidents like mass shootings. They hope to pilot the program in Colorado, where their daughter was killed. For Guns and America, I'm Lee Patterson.
Guns and America is a public media reporting project on the role of guns in American life. Find more at KUNC.org.
Listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your look at news from around the state.
Breckenridge Ski Resort and Copper Mountain Resort both will open on Friday, November 8th, joining the growing list of ski mountains that are already open for the season.
And it's no surprise that the ski industry here in Colorado is big. Here to tell us more about the economic impact of the ski industry and the workforce challenges it's currently facing is Lucas High, a reporter for Biz West. Hi, Lucas.
Hey, Henry. How are you?
Good. Tell us about the state of Colorado's ski industry.
Well, this probably won't come as much a surprise to your listeners, but Colorado ski destinations are extraordinarily popular. They actually set an all-time record in 2018. Ski resorts in the state brought in 13.8 million skiers, which accounts for 20 to 25% of the entire ski visits in the whole country.
Recently, you've been covering skiing, and you've reported on a list of the country's best ski resorts. Six of them here in Colorado, Telluride, Vail, Aspen Snowmass, Beaver Creek Steamboat, and Breckenridge are all in the top 10. What do you make of that?
This was a list that was compiled by a travel website called Snowpack, and I should note that Jackson Hole in Wyoming was the number one. However, as you mentioned, Colorado had six of the top 10 resorts in the country. And, you know, they all sort of share a couple of important factors. One, and these won't be, you know, a surprise to any, you know, avid skiers here in Colorado, but the Colorado resorts on the top 10 list all have, you know, really high quality snow, high diversity of terrain for folks with different skill levels, a lot of available chair lifts. Obviously, folks don't want to be, you know, waiting around all day rather than actually skiing. And another important factor is availability of upscale dining, entertainment, and hospitality hotel options in the areas.
A couple ski resorts have opened in the state early. What does that really mean for business?
For the most part, it's a really good thing for both skiers and the resorts. Obviously, skiers get to get out there on the slopes a little bit earlier than they normally do, and resorts have one extra, or perhaps even in some cases, two extra weekends of revenue as far as lift tickets goes. But it actually puts a little bit of pressure on resorts as far as staffing is concerned. You know, they're is an extraordinarily tight labor market in general, and that's even more of the case in ski country. It's pretty difficult for these resorts to, you know, fully staff up, and if they open a week or two earlier, that kind of just exasperates those workforce issues.
And what does the lack of affordable housing in these ski towns mean for those staffing issues?
Workforce issues are made even more difficult a lot of times by a lack of available affordable housing for folks that work in the hospitality and service industries. There's just, you know, simply not enough, you know, homes available in areas that are far away from metro areas like Vail or Breckenridge or, you know, some of the other ski resorts here in Colorado. And, you know, the fact that the job market is so tight, employees have a little bit more options and they can be a little bit choosier when it comes to the type of jobs that they take. So oftentimes ski resorts hire folks on a seasonal basis and those jobs oftentimes don't include benefits. So, you know, in a tight job market, those jobs are a little bit less attractive for job seekers. An interesting point to note, in Summit County, which is the home to A-Basin, Breckenridge, Copper Mountain, Keystone, the unemployment rate in September, according to Department of Labor and Employment Statistics, was 1.7%. So for the entire Summit County, we're talking about, you know, unemployment claims of about 350 total people. So the labor pool in these areas is very small.
Lucas High is a reporter with BizWest. Lucas, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
And as ski areas open around our state, we're going to celebrate someone who does work behind the scenes to make sure you get down the mountain.
That person is James Niehues. He's the artist behind those trail maps you see at ski resorts, including Breck, Vail, and Winter Park, along with many others. He is also soon to be inducted into the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame's Class of 2019. We visited him in his studio recently to talk about how he goes about designing the maps and what the work has meant to him.
I never knew, and a lot of people that we have talked to as well had this same reaction, but I did not know those ski maps that you see at Ski Mountains are made by a person, you. Do you hear that a lot?
Oh, yes. I've done so many through the years that they just can't quite grasp how many I've done. So I've been doing it for 30 years, and about 200 different resorts have my trail maps.
Can you describe the process of making these beautiful maps?
Well, the most important thing is to remember that we're making a map. So the most important thing is to make sure that it's clear to the skiers of how to get down the mountain. It's important to also portray it in such a manner that when they're on the mountain and they look around, they can relate to the trail map. So they can say, hey, right, I'm right here. And it's something that I really try to do. It's the what my predecessors did. And then, of course, like them, I wanted to make it beautiful too. So it's very important, I think, to get into the painting of it. Today, there's quite a few computer-generated maps out there. And there for a while in the late 1990s and early 2000, the industry was kind of turning to computer because it was the new thing, you know, and it's going to be better. And it was not. A lot of those who return to my work, it's more natural. I'm painting the great outdoors. There are skiers that come in to enjoy the great outdoors. And the computer image is a reflection of the office.
So I wanted to ask you what the history of ski maps being designed by actual people versus just computers. I mean, where is this going?
Well, since the 1960s and Hal Sheldon, they've been painted because that was the only way to do it. There was no computers in those days. Even Hal, by the end of his career, could start seeing that computers were on the horizon. He made a comment one time that we really can't let the human element get out of the map in the making of the map. And that's really how I feel about it. Computers are accurate, and they see things that, in a different way, I believe. And a lot of the computer-generated maps that were in the late 1990s and early 2000s was really, the computers were only used as a tool to do the actual painting. So you never really gained anything. It was still some person's expression, but using a computer. Today it's a little different, and it can be done with satellite imagery, of course, and so forth.
Do you fly over in a plane? How do you get the imagery?
Once I do pick up a job, I get all the information I can from the ski area. Anything like their site maps, their projections on what they have to consider in the future and so forth. And then I'll fly the area. And I'll start very high. I start about 2,000 feet above the ski area and get a lot of panoramic views from different perspectives. And then I'll drop the airplane down to about 500 feet above the summit and do the detail shots of those slopes and drop it even further to about mid-mountain. But we'll fly down 50% down the mountain and get all the detail of the base.
And then you come back, and we're in your studio right now, and then you just begin painting?
Well, no, I'll go through a sketch period when I'll pull out all the photographs and look at them and refer to them and put the mountain together. It's a big puzzle, which I really enjoy. Lots of slopes are facing away from the view, so I need to figure out how I manipulate this mountain in a very realistic way so that all the slopes can be seen on one dimension. Mm-hmm. So I'll work out this sketch. I'll do a very comprehensive sketch, and that is sent to the client. The client will make alterations to it or approve it. And from that, I'll project that image right directly onto the painting surface and then paint the image. Mm-hmm. And once it's painted, it'll be sent again to the client for the final approval.
How accurate are the trees?
The trees are very accurate. I had a fear early on that some skier might ski into a tree, look on the map, say, hey, that wasn't there. So, the nation was Sioux happy. So I've been very careful where I place trees.
Do you think of your maps as pieces of art?
I used to think of them more as maps, but towards 15 years ago onward, I really felt that they were more art than map because I'm really manipulating a lot of the image to get it into one view and playing with a color.
It sounds like this career has been one that's brought you a lot of fulfillment.
When I first started doing this, I was looking for a job. I was looking for a way to make a living. And as I got into it and really got to know the industry and the people in it and the skiers, it became a real passion. Whenever I paint a trail map, I paint it for the skier, not for the resort. And I'll sometimes resist what the resort wants to do because I see the beauty of it, and I want to keep it real and something that they can relate to and trust. And I think it's been so gratifying through the years that I know that I've heard skiers come back and listen to their accolades of, boy, I can trust you. I know that you've done it right. And I look so forward to seeing your map at the ski resort.
What do you think these maps mean to skiers?
Well, I hope, and I get the feedback that skiers will come down and open up the trail maps, and over a beer they'll talk about their day, you know, and what spills they took or what thrills they had, and it just is so gratifying to know that they're looking at my art and reflecting on their skiing.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
James Niehuis is the artist behind hundreds of ski trail maps around the world. Many of his original maps are still in use today. A new book called The Man Behind the Maps features a collection of his work. You can see photos and some of his illustrations at KUNC.org.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll explore the impacts of a recent oil and gas study released by the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.